Okay, in our study of Deuteronomy, we've come to chapter 13. So I'll read the chapter first. Deuteronomy 13. If there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass of which he spoke to you, saying, "Let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them," you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him, and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and hold fast to him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has spoken in order to turn you away from the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of bondage, to entice you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall put away the evil from your midst. If your brother, the son of your mother, your son or your daughter, the wife of your bosom, or your friend who is as your own soul, secretly entices you, saying, "Let us go and serve other gods which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers, of the gods of the people which are all around you, near to you or far off from you, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth, you shall not consent to him or listen to him, nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. And you shall stone him with stones until he dies, because he sought to entice you away from the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. So all Israel shall hear and fear, and not again do such wickedness as this among you. If you hear someone in one of your cities, which the Lord your God gives you to dwell in, saying, 'Corrupt men have gone out from among you,' and entice the inhabitants of their city, saying, 'Let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known,' then you shall inquire, search out, and ask diligently. And if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, all that is in it and its livestock, with the edge of the sword. And you shall gather all its plunder into the middle of the street, and completely burn with fire the city and all its plunder for the Lord your God. It shall be a heap forever. It shall not be built again. So none of the accursed things shall remain in your hand, that the Lord may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy, have compassion on you and multiply you, just as he swore to your fathers. Because you have listened to the voice of the Lord your God to keep all his commandments, which I command you today, to do what is right in the eyes of the Lord your God." Now, I don't know how many people come to Sunday school to hear about three cases of capital punishment, one on the scale of a whole city and the smoldering remains of it. So it might be good up front for me to say what the main point of the chapter is, at least as far as I can see and as far as it applies to us. And then we'll try to work through some of the details of it. So this chapter highlights the majesty and sovereignty of God and the importance of reverencing his name, because he is the redeemer of his people. And so it calls for us a response of total commitment to honor his name. Now, that means, in particular, a certain kind of intolerance of those who would lead us astray. It's especially the emphasis here on the glory of God's name and the terrible sin of blaspheming his name and rebelling against him that you should keep in mind in terms of this chapter. Now, before I go into the details of it, let me make a comment that I on a subject that I alluded to last week. This section of Deuteronomy, which starts in chapter 12 and goes until the covenant renewal ceremony later in the book, toward the end of the book, is a little bit hard to interpret, simply because in the past people have seen it as sort of a jumble of laws. The topic seems to change constantly. It's not always clear why this particular law is given in this context and not somewhere else. Okay, and that's fine. I mean, if God wants to do things that way, then that's his business. But people have asked, is there some structure that has been that is there but hasn't been recognized? And within the last 30 or 40 years, there have been some studies which indicate that there is, in fact, a structure. So this is work by a fellow named Kaufman in the late 70s, and then by Walton, building on that, in the late 80s. And their argument is that this part of the book of Deuteronomy is structured according to the order of the Ten Commandments. So we already saw when we looked at chapters 5 through 11, from the giving of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5, or the re-giving, however you want to look at it, through chapter 11, is an emphasis on the first commandment, which is, in some sense, a summary of all the commandments, to love God with all our hearts, and in particular not to have any other gods. And then we saw last week in chapter 12 that the focus was on the second commandment, which is, I think it's a fairly clear connection there, because it's a question of how you worship the true God. And they're told not to worship the true God the way the Canaanites worship. Don't even inquire about how they worship the true God. And historically, in Reform circles, Deuteronomy 12 has been used as a proof text for what we call now the regulative principle of worship. So it makes sense for Deuteronomy 12 to fit in that pattern then, the second commandment is treated. And so these folks argue that, in fact, you can trace that through, as I said, the main part of the book now until the renewal of the covenant ceremony, renewal later on. And that's, I think, a very helpful way of thinking of things. So in the break and between when we were doing, finished chapter 11 and before we started chapter 12, we watched those videos, I read through Deuteronomy asking whether this seemed to work. I tried to keep something of an open mind, and I came out of it not really sure whether it works or not. Okay, so what happens is that you can interpret the laws in terms of different commandments. Okay, and that's because the law is closely interrelated. The ninth commandment about bearing false witness is closely connected with the third commandment, which is not taking God's name in vain, because bearing false witness was typically in a court of law where you took an oath to speak the truth in God's name. So perjury was an offense against the third commandment. And other ways. I mean, the last commandment, you shall not covet, covers a lot of the laws. Paul says covetousness is idolatry. So it's a little difficult to insist this passage is directly related to this commandment and no other. But I did find as I read through that there is some sense of that. There does seem to be a general flow of moving through the commandments, even if there's certainly some uncertain passages. And I think that will be a helpful point of view. I'll mention it occasionally as we go through, maybe not all the time, just to see which commandment this is relevant to. By the way, you know, you may be suspicious of something that was written in the late 70s and late 80s, but in fact, that historically the Reformed have seen the law as all, the moral law is all hanging on the Ten Commandments. The moral law is really an exposition of the Ten Commandments. And so this scholarship is really a return in some sense to a Reformed position, even though one of the articles was written in a dispensationalist journal. The argument is really that the moral law is worked out and spelled out for us in this section of Deuteronomy. Whether it's in the particular order of the Ten Commandments may not be that important, but it's a point of view I've already emphasized, that if you really want to understand what it means not to bear false witness, then read the way the Old Testament works that out. Now, it may be that the specific outworking doesn't apply to us, but we learn about the what's called the equity of the law, how it should apply in a variety of circumstances. So here in chapter 13, there could be some debate here, but I think it does make sense that chapter 13 is connected with the third commandment, because it's specifically a question about the honor of God's name. Those who seek to lead people astray are really blaspheming God's name, and those who stand up against them, who exercise this intolerance, are really honoring God's name. It's because of the sense of the majesty of God's name that this rather intolerant behavior, apparently, is to be exercised. So I'll come back to that as we see more details. But I don't know if you've thought about this part of Deuteronomy in those terms or not, but it's a helpful way to think of things. Okay, so let's go through then and think of the outworking of what I said was the basic point. So this is highlighting the majesty of God's name and therefore the response of commitment on our part. The chapter is fairly easy to structure. There are three I guess you could call hypothetical situations. They're not hypothetical in the sense that you could never imagine them being realized, but they all begin with an if. So verse 1, if there arises a prophet or a dreamer among you. Verse 6, if your brother, and then again in verse 12, if you hear someone in one of the cities. So you could summarize the three scenarios as being the false prophet, the false friend, and the false city, where in each case the falseness has to do maybe not with our respect to us, but with respect to their allegiance to God. In each case, it's a betrayal of allegiance to God. So that's in which the sense in which the prophet, the friend, and that's understood in a broad sense, and the city are all false. So there are three cases. They're all tending to lead people to apostasy, to turn away from God. And you can see that just by the one phrase, or one of the phrases, that's in common with each of them. And notice in verse 2, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them. So that appears in each of the three scenarios. That's the basic point. They want to lead people astray from the true God to gods that you have not known. Okay, we talked about this phrase before. It is emphasizing that they have known the true God. Okay, so they would have known about these other gods, but these other gods have not redeemed them. They have not loved them the way the true God has. And in return, they haven't known these gods. They haven't given this worship to them. It's something completely contrary to the allegiance which you would expect, because these are gods to whom they had no allegiance. Okay. So that is an implied contrast, but then the stated contrast is worked out different ways in different scenarios, but the sense of affront it is to God is especially spelled out in verse 5, for example. He is seeking to turn you away from the Lord your God, who what? Who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of bondage. Okay. Sounds like the preface to the Ten Commandments. Actually, you can hear that in many different places. But you see, it's really saying that this is striking at the heart of the covenant relationship that God has established and the law that's being exposited by Moses here. It's striking at the heart of that, of who God is, as our covenant God, as our Redeemer. Now, you might say, well, if that's the case, how could these things be even more than hypothetical? If that was really their God, how is it possible that this could actually happen in practice? Well, or just study history, I guess, is the short answer. But if you read each of the situations, especially the first two, you can see that there's a special temptation or a special part of the situation that makes this a real temptation. So in the first case, it's a prophet. So this is a person who claims to speak for God, the reference to dreamer of dreams. Okay, so I guess we're all dreamers of dreams. But this has to do with the way God especially revealed himself, especially you think of the Old Testament, but it's in the New Testament as well. And this person claimed then to speak on behalf of God, as to be a prophet, but he was a false prophet because he sought to lead them astray, to seek other gods. So what was it that would have caused them to listen to this person? Well, it is that he gives a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass. So this could be a prophecy of some future event. This could have been some apparent miracle that the person works. So you see, there is a reason why this person might attract attention. He's not just Joe the prophet. Okay, he actually does something which attracts attention, and there's a certain credibility about that. In fact, later on in Deuteronomy, this will be one of the ways the true prophet is confirmed. That is, by predicting the future accurately. So there's something here that would get their attention. And the second scenario is probably even clearer, at least closer to home to us. It's the brother, the son of your mother, the son of your daughter, the wife of your bosom or your friend. So this is a close relationship. I said friend, but friend is mentioned here, but it could be someone with whom you have a close family relationship. And that person is tempting you in the same way to go and serve other gods. And you can see how that would be a real temptation, how if someone that close to you sought to lead you astray, that you would indeed be tempted. The third case is something on a grander scale, and that is when a whole city is involved. And we'll come back to that later. It's it's in effect what happens if the other two cases get out of hand. You could think of it that way. But I want you to notice especially what's underlying all of these, and that's a certain pressure of conformity. So notice this in verse 7 how that gods which you have not known is spelled out. In verse 7 it says, of the gods of the people which are all around you, near to you or far off from you, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. Okay? In other words, everyone's doing it. Okay? If you want to interpret that in terms we can understand, why do we need to serve this one God? Look at all the possibilities. And look how popular these other gods are elsewhere. So there is a pressure of conformity and a sense of narrowness in serving the one true God, which is in fact what it is. Matthew Henry comments on this and sort of applies it to our own situation or his own situation. He says, this suggestion draws many away from religion and godliness, that it is an unfashionable thing. And they make their court to the world and the flesh because these are the gods of the people that are round about them. That is a real temptation. And if you want to think in not in terms of serving other gods. I mean, I have myself haven't been tempted to serve Baal this past week, but we all sense the pressure to conform. And I don't mean, you know, the fashionable. I don't mean it's bad to buy an iPod or something like that. We're talking about the sort of pressure to conform that involves a betrayal of the true God. Okay, I don't think iPods involve that. So it's a more fundamental sort of thing than that. Now, what is their reaction to be? Well, they're told not to listen to this person, and they're told to put the rebels to death. That's the outcome in each three of the circumstances. As I said, I'll come back to that later in terms of, you know, what does that mean for us? But it's really easy to focus on that and to be offended. You know, how could you read a chapter like this in a tolerant day? But the point is really to focus on the fact that God is the covenant head. And this this metaphor, it's actually probably not a metaphor, it's pretty close to literal, is many times given by commentators. God was the head of state for the nation. Okay? And this was treason against God. What these people were doing was treason against God. Now, in most nations, treason, attempting to overthrow the government, attempting to even in some situations, to besmirch the name of the ruler. We don't take that one too seriously now, but that sort of thing deserved the death penalty. If you seek to overthrow the government, right, you deserve capital punishment. And that's the sense that you should have here. God is the glorious, majestic head of his people. He redeemed them to himself. He brought them into this covenant relationship. In this sense, the gap between the first 11 chapters and what we're doing now maybe isn't so helpful, but I hope we develop that sense of God's calling for our complete allegiance because he has saved us and loved us. And in particular, he was the head of the nation. And so this was treason against God, against the majesty and name of God. And therefore, the understandable response is to be intolerant, to say we won't deal with that. We won't allow that. You should be put to death because you're overthrowing the great majestic king who has saved us. So that's to put it, you might say, in a negative way, we will put them to death, but in a positive way, we're recognizing the majesty of the one who has saved us. And there's a blessing associated with that. The chapter doesn't end with the smoldering ruins in verse 16, but it says that God will have compassion on you and multiply you, and he will bless you. It is this majestic God who has blessed them, who has given them the land that they're anticipating entering. Again, they're still on the border of Canaan here, but it's that God and his great majesty that they should have before him. And therefore, any sense of intolerance is a natural reaction. It would be a strange thing if we had no zeal for the name of the God who had saved us in that way. Now, I'll try to turn next to some of the details because I just sort of lumped all three of the cases together, but there's actually a progression in the chapter as well as some important details for each of them. But let me pause and see No one's getting ready to throw stones at me for being so intolerant yet. So any questions, comments? Okay, so first a sense of the progression. The first two scenarios, that is with the false prophet and the false friend, as I called it, both involve the instigation of the rebellion, if you will. So it's someone saying, let us go and do this, and in both cases. The third case involves that, you might say, coming to full bloom. So that this instigation has gone so far that a whole city is given over to that. And as I mentioned before, there's a sense, I think, implied in that, that if you don't check the evil at the beginning, then it will come to a situation where you're facing the eradication of a whole city. Eradication of a whole city, lest the whole nation, in fact, rebel against the one true God. And that would be the end of all things, because God's judgment would be against them. In fact, that's what happened later on in history. So the third scenario sounds very serious, and it would be a serious thing to contemplate going against one of your own cities. But you might read it as saying, if in fact you want to think about why you need to be careful about cases 1 and 2, it's because case 3 is unthinkable. How could you imagine going against one of your own cities? Okay, so let me make then some comments on each of them individually. The case of the false prophet. And here is an unusual circumstance where apparently a wonder has occurred, and the people are therefore to pay attention, but it's a wonder which leads them astray. And you can look at other references like this. Zechariah 13, Matthew 24, probably one that would be most helpful to read is 2 Thessalonians 2, where Paul talks about lying signs and wonders, and they will lead astray those who are already in rebellion against God. It's a pretty close parallel, actually, with this first scenario. So there are cases that are mentioned in the Scripture where these signs and wonders are intended to lead people astray. And it's a reminder to us that whatever signs and wonders there are need to be connected with the Word. Maybe if I could put it in current terms, we, maybe especially American evangelicals, tend to be experience-oriented. If we see something, if it seems to work, if it seems to make us feel good, then we tend to think that that's the thing we should do. And there's something good about that, because you do see God at work in different ways, but the danger is that those things can lead us astray if they're not rooted in doctrine, if they're not rooted in what the Word teaches about God. And that's exactly the danger here, right? They should have known without question that going and serving other gods is not an option. Okay, but the impressive sign or wonder which the person apparently did was enough to lead them astray. I'll give you an interesting historical example. Okay, I'm not picking on Pentecostals, it's just an interesting historical example. So about 100 years ago, the Pentecostal movement was very strong in the U.S. They were growing, and one of the things that for them confirmed the truth of what they were teaching, and there were various aspects of their teaching, was the fact that there were various manifestations of the Spirit as they understood them. Now, we think of speaking in tongues, but there were other things associated with that. And that was to them an evidence that the whole movement was a valid movement from God. And then, among the Pentecostals arose a group that denied the Trinity. So we know them now as the United Pentecostal Church. There's a congregation in town, the United Pentecostal Church. They had a historically represented view, if you could put it that way, of the Trinity. It's called modalism or Sabellianism. That is, there are not three persons within the Godhead. There's only one person. God the Son is God the Father is God the Spirit, in the sense that they're all the same person. They just manifest themselves in different ways at different times. It's a heresy. I mean, everyone recognized that as a heresy. But within the Pentecostal movement, this group arose that taught that, and they had the same manifestations as the others. They had the same speaking in tongues, the same manifestations of the Spirit. So what was used before to validate the truth of their experience, the truth of their doctrine, namely their experience, in the mainline Pentecostal movement, was now validating a heresy, which they recognized to be heresy. Let that be a warning to us. Again, I'm not picking on Pentecostals. Every group needs to be careful about simply falling after experience, and instead always tying together the word and the sign that goes with the word. The second case, as I mentioned earlier, the case of the false friend probably doesn't need much explanation. It's just very disturbing to think of someone who is that close to you to lead you astray. You can see the vulnerability implied in that. Commentators give examples like Adam with Eve, or Jesus who was tempted by Peter. Of course, Jesus didn't go astray. And also call to mind Jesus' words in the Gospels that the one who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. So Jesus himself warns us about the temptations that come among those family relationships and friendships. Just briefly on the third scenario, the false city, as I called it, in Deuteronomy 13. It's instigated by, as it says here, corrupt men. So the literal Hebrew is sons of Belial. Belial is applied by Paul in the New Testament to the devil. Anyway, these are worthless people. These are troublemakers, but it's like trouble with a capital T. That sounds like the Music Man or something. Sorry. I mean, it is trouble in the sense that it causes, in the end, ruin for the whole city. And that outcome of that trouble is described here in terms, well, they're shocking. Verse 15, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of the city with the edge of the sword. And they're not to keep the plunder. That would be, by the way, one disincentive for doing that. If you just, you know, like the bank account in this city, you could just burn them and take their wealth. That's not an option here. But it goes as far as taking all the plunder in the middle of the street and burning it all, implied as really an offering to God. Now, this sounds familiar, I think, because this was the instruction for the way they were to treat the Canaanite cities. Right? When they went into the land of Canaan, they weren't always forbidden to take the spoil. But in extreme cases, they were. And this is, in essence, saying that those who do this have become like Canaanites. Only they're worse than Canaanites, right? Because they've known the true God. They had the light of the gospel, as Galatians describes the understanding of the Old Testament believers. They've had that light, and yet they've turned away from it. And so they become a terrible example of the wrath of God against those who would rebel against him. Okay, so let's think then thirdly, so those are some of the details. Let's think thirdly of the way we can apply this. I've mentioned some of these already, but the first question is this something that we should be doing today? Putting blasphemers to death and burning cities. Well, the short answer is no. I don't know if anyone's relieved by that. But I want to say both positively and negatively some things about it. First of all, historically, the Reformed have emphasized that the civil magistrate has obligations with respect to both tables of the law. Okay, that's the standard phrase. What does that mean? Okay, that means, you know, we think of the civil magistrate, the government, as being responsible to put murderers to death and to enforce laws against stealing. That would be the second table of the law, as it's typically understood. But historically, the Reformed have understood that the rulers, even in the civil realm, have some responsibility with respect to the first four commandments. Now, I know that's controversial, and I know it violates separation of church and state as some people understand it, but that's historic Reformed teaching. You can see it in the Westminster Standards, and our own testimony supports that to the extent that the civil ruler is supposed to submit to the Lord Jesus as the ruler. Psalm 2 would be one simple place to look at that, and to rule according to his will. But having said that, we don't live in a covenanted nation, maybe you noticed, and we, in fact, don't have the same situation as the people in the Old Testament did. It is, therefore, impossible for one simply to enforce laws like this in our situation. And Calvin, in particular, who actually understands the need for applying this sort of law in his own day, or understood that in his own day, still emphasize that this was a society in which the people had voluntarily joined into covenant with God. It was a nation which acknowledged the one true God to be their God. And that's certainly not the situation that we're in. In terms of the specific penalty of death, I would say that's a completely separate topic. There's been a lot of discussion connected with whether the specific penalty is connected with the law or whether there is simply the equity of the law that should be applied. The Westminster Confession talks about the civil laws not applying further than the equity thereof. Whether the penalty itself is part of the equity of the law is a separate question. But before I leave this, the discussion about the civil realm, which is probably not very satisfactory, I'm saying it's not realistic to think about it in our circumstances, let me make two comments. First of all, this is not mob violence that's being described here. Okay? So when you read about, you know, a city being destroyed, don't forget verse 14. You shall inquire, search out, and ask diligently. This was by far the last resort. This was something that they would only do if they had certain knowledge. And even in the case of the friend, when we think about stoning him with stones, people of my age think of that short story, The Lottery, and, you know, it's like a completely arbitrary sort of thing. But the point is that this is the hand being first against him says, I'm the chief witness and I'm standing by what I'm saying. This is not simply mob violence. This is a careful investigation that was called for here. And there are certainly cases historically where people got it wrong. Think of Jesus. In fact, if you look in the New Testament and look at the references that the Pharisees and other rulers used with respect to Jesus as a blasphemer and therefore should be put to death, they probably would have looked at Deuteronomy 13. Okay. So, again, the sign that Jesus gave was connected with the truth from God, but they rejected the truth from God in their case. So it's simply a warning that not only in Jesus' time, but again at the time of the Reformation, many faithful reformers were burned at the stake. It's not a license for persecution. It is rather a call for zeal for the name of God that's worked out carefully and with reason. But maybe closer than to us, if I'm not going to apply it to the civil realm in the way some people might think I would. Second of all, this law shows the severity of God's wrath against those who would blaspheme his name. As we noted in the description of the destruction of Canaan and the smoldering cities there, this is really a picture of hell. That city which is destroyed is described as burning. In fact, in verse 5, the reference to exterminating or getting rid of the evil in their midst is also a reference to burning. It's a solemn picture of the wrath of God against sin. And this is something, actually, that the writer to the Hebrews takes up in chapter 10. He may well be alluding to Deuteronomy 13 and verse 8, especially with the idea of not showing mercy, when he says that we have an even greater responsibility because we have the light of the gospel, even a greater light of the gospel than they did in the Old Testament, and certainly a greater light than the Canaanites did. And we therefore have a higher responsibility. He was warning those who were tempted to turn away from the living God, the Hebrews were, back to the ways of false Judaism. And so it is a warning for us as well that that God has high standards for those who have high privileges. Just two more applications that I'll mention. And the third is, two more of four, so the next one is church discipline. Okay, the church is not the state. This capital punishment that took place here would have been done by the civil magistrate and not by the priest. But many of the arguments that are used here are also used in the New Testament to give reasons for why we should be careful not to let false doctrine or false living go among us. That is, that the church should, in a sense, be intolerant, that is, of of the leaven which would leaven the whole lump. So here a reference would be 1 Corinthians 5. And if you look at the reasons that are given there and elsewhere, you can see, as I said, many of the same sorts of things. First of all, church discipline is important because of the glory of God. Okay? We often think of it in terms of ourselves, just as we read Deuteronomy 13 and think of it in terms of the victim, if you want to call those people who got killed. But the whole orientation is to the glory of God, and that's why church discipline is important. It is Christ's church, and his name should be regarded as holy. But it's also emphasized in 1 Corinthians 5 that church discipline is important for the protection of the rest of the church. Okay, and that's repeated here. I didn't really highlight that in Deuteronomy 13, but notice in verse 5 at the end, "So you shall put away the evil from your midst." As I already made the point, if they didn't put away the evil from their midst in the case of the one prophet, it could come to the situation where a whole city was corrupted by it. So Paul says, you know, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. Be careful in the church not to be proud of your tolerance, which apparently they were at the beginning of 1 Corinthians 5. He seems to say that. But instead, they should seek to maintain purity of the church at a certain level, as far as they can see. And also that the rest of the people should be warned by it. There's another interesting point here, which I'll just mention briefly, and that is we often think of circumstances like this as being completely worthless, especially for those who are in authority, simply very difficult circumstance. It's hard to see any value in it. But Paul actually encourages the point of view, as Deuteronomy does here, that there is something good that comes out of it. Notice in Deuteronomy 13:3, "The Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." There's a way to prove our love for God, to be willing to take up the hard circumstances and ask hard questions to preserve the glory of God's name. Okay, and then lastly, just as an application, I've already talked about the civil realm, I've talked about the church realm. What about on the individual level? Well, there's an emphasis both in the Old and New Testaments of building good associations. Okay, now, it is possible to find yourself in the situation of verse 6 where the close friend leads you astray. But the scriptures consistently warn us against alliances that are entangling. So we think of 2 Corinthians 6:14, "Do not be unequally yoked with believers." It applies to marriage. It applies to lots of other relationships. Or 1 Corinthians 10, the Apostle Paul warns against communion with idolaters and idolatry in terms of the practice of the pagans in Corinth. So this chapter is a reminder to us to be careful in our alliances. Okay? Now, there's a balance there. I don't really like that word, but there is a balance here because you don't want to cut off all associations with the world. You want to be able to speak to the unbeliever. But the one who is as your own soul may secretly entice you, and you should therefore be sure as you can, of that one who is as your own soul is having a common love for God, the same love you do. So ultimately, the chapter speaks then about whether we are willing to be intolerant, whether we have the zeal for the name of God that recognizes his true majesty. But it actually works out in practice in, you might say, very practical ways. Not the wide-eyed fanatic, you know, goes around stabbing people he thinks are idolaters or something like that. That's not our calling. It has to do with the zeal for God in our day-to-day lives and thinking about how we form friendships, how we look to marriage, various other relationships, and cause us really to search our hearts and ask whether the glory of God and recognition of his majesty is the chief aim in all of our relationships. Okay, stoning with stones, smoldering cities. Any comments or questions? Yes, Vicki.
How would you define blasphemers?
In general, blasphemy is speaking something against God. So that's pretty general. Jesus was said to be a blasphemer because he claimed to be the Son of God and therefore made himself equal with God. On their understanding, that was impossible and therefore was considered to be blasphemy. But in this context, the blasphemy was... Yeah, it's a good question, because calling them to serve other gods doesn't directly speak against God. But the way it's explained in the context in terms of the God who had saved them, it's an affront to the name of God. It's really saying that that God is not sufficient for us. He is not the one who can care for us. We'd rather go this other way. So that's a really an excellent question. I'm glad you picked up on that point, because it touches on this the question I raised at the beginning about how it fits in the Ten Commandments. In a sense, it fits more with the first commandment, because you're not supposed to worship other gods. But I did get the sense as I meditated on this chapter that really to understand it, you need to have the sense of the majesty of God, which is what the third commandment is about. And so it's blasphemy in that sense that even on the part of the person, not the one who's saying let us serve other gods, but the person who's deciding what to do with that, the temptation is to blaspheme God by saying, well, he didn't call my mother some bad name. He just called God a bad name. So it's the tendency for us not to reverence the name of God when we hear other people misusing it. And I don't just mean saying God or Jesus when they shouldn't be. But the temptation to put aside any call to false dealing out of...
Deny God's sovereignty.
That's what it comes to, yeah. That's right. Very good, thank you.
So you would say that like blasphemy and maybe even taking the Lord's name in vain is as much about the way we live as it is about what we say? Like,
sure, yeah.
If we're living in a way that doesn't glorify God, or even if we're not trusting God and just...
Right. Yeah, so there's a recurrent phrase in Ezekiel, I guess it is. Paul takes it up in Romans. The name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. So they went out, they were supposed to be the promised land, but the Babylonians had to wipe them out in the wrath of God because they wouldn't listen to God. And then they went into Babylon and they blasphemed God's name wherever they went. Well, that's serious stuff. I'm sure they didn't go around cursing God, but the way they lived before the heathen was a way of taking God's name in vain. Yeah, that's very good. That's right. Well, it's very bad, but that's a good observation. Yeah. Yeah. Good questions. Okay, let's close on prayer.